Some presidents spend their post-presidency building homes for the poor or raising money for charity or painting their toes. Trump has spent his figuring out how to pull off the coup he couldn't pull off last time.
Yeah, sounds about right. Have you noticed?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Have the media noticed?
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Hope so.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Not that they're acting
and
like
I'm
it.
I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake, California. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding, on KFOI, Round Mountains, KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast, on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow. Says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today, and welcome to the Bradcast. We have been discussing over the past few days on the Bradcast the media's failure to adequately cover and warn the American public of the rising dangers of the authoritarian right in this country after Donald Trump's attempt to steal, yes, steal the 2020 election, and his continuing 100% evidence-free claims that the 2020 election was stolen from him. As that false claim has been mainstreamed by the Republican Party itself at this point, many regard what has happened over the past almost full year now, including the deadly Trump-incited insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, the radical overhaul of election laws in key swing states to both suppress the votes of certain voters and, more ominously, to allow partisan GOP legislatures to simply overturn election results nearly on a whim. Many regard that as just, oh, now it's normal in these United States. Nothing to worry about, just more of Donald Trump and his, you know, making noise. Everything's fine. Well, I'm not sure everything is fine, and I am not sure that our mainstream corporate media is adequately warning the public, setting off the alarm bells, if you will, about what we are looking towards in the next year or two or three. We will talk about a bit more about that, and if time allows, take some of your calls on it at 818-985-5735 if you want to line up early on how the media, including, yes, your friendly neighborhood Bradcast, if you like, could and should be doing a better job of sounding that alarm of what is now underway in this country with an unprecedented rise of political violence, at least unprecedented in modern times in this country, and threats that the Republican Party, no matter how much evidence they are shown, will simply refuse to accept results that of elections that they do not win. But before we slide down into that deep, dark rabbit hole once again today, let's begin with, what suffices for slightly brighter news. at least for some of us out here in Southern California in the listening area here, but really for everyone, a week after we first covered this story, a small bit of good news today, even if the larger story is not particularly bright at all, as we will discuss with my guest, a U.S. congressman, momentarily. So here's the bright part. Pay attention because it doesn't last long. A Southern California beach that was closed more than a week ago because of what was reported as a massive leak of crude oil from an undersea pipeline was reopened on Monday, far sooner than many expected. Huntington Beach's city and state beaches reopened after officials said water quality tests revealed no detectable levels of oil-associated toxins in the ocean water. Huntington Beach and nearby coastal communities reeled from last week's spill that officials said sent at least 25,000 gallons and no more than 132,000 gallons, or about 3,000 barrels of oil, into the ocean. That's quite a disparity in estimates, frankly, between 25,000 and 132,000, which I will ask my guest about momentarily as well. The spill was caused by a leak in a pipeline owned by the Houston-based Amplify Energy that shuttles crude from offshore platforms to the coast. The leak occurred about 5 miles off the coast of California in what is considered federal waters. Though, as it turns out, those same waters, those same federal waters, actually wash in to the state California coastline, believe it or not. And the sensitive protected habitat along that coastline, no matter how the area offshore is characterized by federal law. By Sunday of this weekend, there was no smell of oil and the sand looked largely clear at the Huntington Beach Pier. According to news reports, the workers were still combing the sand for tar. But local officials worry about the environmental impact of the spill on the wetlands and the wildlife and the economy. Officials in the city of 200,000 people have said that the water testing will continue for at least 2 more weeks, but the community dubbed Surf City USA saw relatively few people at the beach, and the shops that cater to them have been hurting over the past week. Some have been forced to close altogether since the spill. Popular surfing and swimming spots in nearby Newport Beach and Laguna Beach, however, remained closed as of Monday. It could be a year or 2 years to get the tourism back to come back, noted Mike Ali, one shop owner who has reduced hours for employees and closed 3 of his 4 locations. Ali noted that a 1990 oil spill in the same area wound up diverting would-be visitors to beaches south and north of the city for years. As to what caused the leak, well, that's still not been absolutely determined, though the working theory right now seems to be that a ship's anchor may have dragged a half-mile section of the 17.5-mile pipeline that feeds back to refineries in Long Beach, resulting in a small fracture that may have gone unnoticed by the company for days. The matter of why it took so many hours, even after multiple reports of a petroleum smell by residents in Huntington Beach, oiled boat hulls, and even a satellite report of a possible oil slick by NOAA before either the Coast Guard or the company responded to shut the pipeline down. All of that remains unanswered at this hour. The incident, just another in a string of similar drilling disasters up and down the coast over the past 5 decades, has now renewed calls in California to ban offshore drilling. California, one of the largest oil markets in the nation, ironically enough, has been a leader in restricting offshore oil drilling since the infamous 1969 Santa Barbara spill that sparked the modern environmental movement in this country. And while the state's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom last week said he shared the concerns and hopes of those calling for an end of oil drilling in the Golden State and off its shores in both state and federal waters, the governor, speaking at Huntington Beach last week, claimed it was easier said than done. That, while the state has not issued a new lease in state waters in 5 decades, drilling from existing platform nonetheless continues. Similarly, an effort in Congress that aims to halt new drilling in federal waters, that's more than 3 miles off the coast, would not stop drilling that is already happening now. The governor said banning new drilling is complicated. Quote, the deeper question is, how do you transition and still protect the workforce? That with some 19 oil and gas agreements in California's coastal waters and 1,200 active wells along with them in federal waters. In fact, there are 23 oil and gas production facilities off the state's coast right now. Speaking alongside Governor Newsom last week was Congressman Alan Lowenthal, a Democrat and member of the House Progressive Caucus. He represents part of Orange County. He said the federal government needs to do more. He said, quote, we have to come up with a plan to not only stop new drilling, but to figure out how do we stop all drilling that's going on in California. Last week, Lowenthal issued a press release calling for a congressional investigation into the Orange County spill, charging, quote, it is clear that offshore fossil fuel production in federal waters represents one of the greatest risks to the public and our environment and must be one of the first sources that are completely phased out. Joining us now is Congressman Alan Lowenthal, who has represented California's 47th Congressional District, encompassing portions of eastern L.A. County and western Orange County and the city of Long Beach, which neighbors Huntington Beach since 2013. He has represented them. Before that, he served for many years as a Long Beach City Council member, then in the State Assembly and Senate, for many years thereafter until being elected to Congress in 2012. Congressman Alan Lowenthal, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Brad.
Delighted to have you. So first, good news that the beach at Huntington Beach has reopened as of today. Beaches in Newport and Laguna, as I understand, remain closed. What's the status for beaches in your nearby district of in Long Beach, which is where the pipeline terminated, I believe, following last week's spill?
The pipeline terminates in Long Beach, and the actual four platforms, LA being the one that does the processing and sends the oil to, is somewhere south of Long Beach, but it's kind of on the border between Orange and L.A. County.
Mm-hmm.
So the tidal influence after the break, which was kind of on the border between Long Beach and maybe Huntington Beach, the waters blew everything to the south and not to the north. So there was no real impact. Long Beach on the coastline anyway, and it doesn't seem like Seal Beach in Orange County there was any impact. It really began in Huntington Beach, and that's where the impact was.
No.
And has gone down and continues to go down the coast, and while Huntington Beach has now opened up, the city of Huntington Beach has opened up their beaches, we still see tar balls now into San Diego County. That's where the impact is being felt at this moment.
Now, we first heard, Congressman, that 126,000 gallons were spilled. Then it was upped to, I think, as high as 144,000 gallons. Now it's believed to be anywhere from as high as 132,000 down to 25,000 gallons. Shouldn't we have a more reliable number a full week out from this spill?
Well, we need a comprehensive report, and we need a report to really understand not only what took place, when it took place, when it was reported to the federal officials, what happened in the period when it wasn't, so we know when was the oil shut off. All of that is still unknown, and it's being investigated. So I think while the Coast Guard and the Fish and Wildlife and the state of California is investigating that. They're not giving out anything official until they have a comprehensive report, which we should see in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Now, more
exactly what took place.
Yeah. Well, more trouble. Actually, for me, the most troubling, I think. Well, there's a lot of troubling stuff here, but we've covered many of the protests against both new and existing pipelines over the years in detail, from, Keystone XL to Dakota Access to the ongoing fights right now against Line 3 up in Minnesota. And every time in all of those stories, we hear from the pipeline owners that we don't need to worry because the pipelines, they have the latest technology to detect, the instant that there's a leak, so the pipeline can automatically be shut down. Well, this leak, as we understand it, according to investigators, appears to have gone on anywhere from about 10 hours to several days before it was finally shut down by the company. Doesn't that sort of put the lie to all of these claims about safe, high-tech pipeline technology by all of these companies? We don't need to worry.
Well, it's shocking, and I agree with you. It does put the lie. But even more so is in California, we're really talking about, and you've raised the issue between onshore and offshore.
Mm-hmm.
In California, there have not been any new offshore pipelines in 40 years, so there
right.
is no new technology. It's all old technology. It's all corroding. It's all waiting for the next disaster to occur. While on onshore, at least they can say, well, we're watching it. It's the best technology. We don't have the best technology out here. We have the oldest and the worst technology in terms of our offshore pipelines coming into onshore.
Which is not good for the offshore pipelines.
No, it's terrible. It's just terrible.
Nor is it good for, we have a lot of drilling onshore as well, according to
absolutely
the nonprofit Frack Tracker Alliance. More than 2 million California residents live within 2,500 feet of an active oil or gas well. An additional 5 million, that's 14% of the state's population, actually live within 1 mile of an active oil or gas well, which doesn't even include, I don't think, the many wells and platforms and pipelines that are offshore. Now, last week, Congressman, you called for all drilling going on in California to be shut down, which I join you in, by the way. There are a number of refineries, I believe, in your district in Long Beach. How would that affect the many refineries and other related businesses in your district and up and down the coastline?
Well, I think the transition has to begin to renewables and to closing down our fossil fuel development. Right now, I think the first focus is, and I want to kind of be a little bit, kind of wonky and to say, really, what has been called for, what is the legislation, and what mm-hmm. we really need to call for. As you pointed out, California, there's been a number of pieces of legislation by Mr. Huffman in the north, by Mr. Levin, my dear friend in Orange County,
mm-hmm.
calling for no new leases of any. And that's what the Department of Interior does. They
mm-hmm.
sell leases to oil companies or to individuals who want to develop it
mm-hmm.
to do oil and gas development. In 2016, just before Mr. Obama left office, he did a 5-year plan which called for no sale of any leases off the coast of the Atlantic coast,
mm-hmm.
the eastern part of the Gulf, and California. He wasn't in office more than a fraction of a minute that Trump's handpicked oil and gas person, who is the head of he selected as the head of the Interior, Mr. Zinke.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Zinke said, we're going to start to do drilling off the coast of the Atlantic, the Eastern Gulf, and also California, and basically all of the West Coast.
Yeah.
And so he lifted the 5-year moratorium that the president Obama had
right.
said, which was supposed to last until 2021. But Zinke lifted it, the president lifted it by executive order. And so California and other states said, wait a second, we don't want this. Even Florida, which was part of the order, the Republican governor in Florida said, no way are we going to have oil drilling on the eastern coast of Florida.
Yeah.
And so they took Florida out of the equation.
Yeah, they got out of it because they had a governor that Donald Trump liked and wanted to get along with and wanted to win re-election.
Absolutely.
So Florida was off
the
hook.
That's exactly what it is. And really what this was an attempt to stick it to California, one of the many attempts by the Trump administration to stick it to California.
Mm-hmm.
So they were going to open up the West Coast to leasing. Even though California, you know, and it would have been very, very difficult, because if what we're talking about in federal waters, to do new leasing, new drilling on new, to sell new leases,
mm-hmm.
would be to set up platforms in federal water to mm-hmm. do where the drilling would be, where the leasing would take place. But it would take pipelines from those places, like what we saw the other day with the spill when mm-hmm. the pipeline broke.
Yeah.
But it would have to come through state waters and come, as you pointed out, into Long Beach, into
mm-hmm.
where it can be then transported to a refinery from once it mm-hmm. arrived at the pumping station in Long Beach. And not all of it would be in Long Beach. They up and down the coast.
Sure.
They would like to, you know, to do that. Well, the state would not allow that. None of the states along the Pacific would allow any new leases. But we still didn't have in statute getting rid of the sale of any new leases, even with the Biden administration.
Mm-hmm.
There and not wanting to open up any new leases, we still need to put that into statute. But that's just the first step, because as you pointed out rightfully, not selling any new leases means that you can't do any new drilling on different land than's already being operated, where there
mm-hmm.
are old leases already there.
Right.
What we need to figure out is what's the plan, as I pointed out, to really do the decommissioning of what's out there. There are legal issues that involve decommissioning when somebody has already gotten a permit. But there are things that go on. Right now, for example, take the platform Ellie, which was connected to the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
There are three platforms that lead to Ellie. Ellie is the processing, was and still is the processing one. It,
mm-hmm.
it takes the oil that's drilled on Edith, Ellen, or Eureka. And in those three things, Edith, there are over 70 wells. So each platform may have multiple and dozens of wells
right.
on the platform. And so what happens is, even though we stop the new sale of new leases,
right.
we still have all these wells. And when a company wants to change how they're drilling, to do fracking out there, to do acidification, to do slant drilling, they have to go to Interior, to BSEE, which
mm-hmm.
is the agency, and get a permit to do that. So we still did that. That's allowed because they're already drilling on those leases to modify that. That has to change. We have to change the whole process of, and the way we can do that, there are two ways we can do that, what we need to do. The first way we need to do it is to make sure that the permitting is really tied to environmental impacts and
mm-hmm.
environmental measures. We're not going to offer new permits when we can assess that any permit runs the risk with the old pipelines of causing. We're not going to allow new kinds of drilling. So that's going to take federal action, and that's going to be difficult because there are lots of folks outside of California that don't believe, first of all, they don't believe in California, and they don't believe in climate and change, and they don't want to really stop that. They want to be energy independent. But we have to do that. And the second thing that's even more is that, or maybe not more, that we have to do immediately is, when these platforms were first developed off the Pacific,
mm-hmm.
they were done by the large oil companies
mm-hmm.
who saw this as an avenue to enrich themselves. There were untapped resources out there. Well, they've tapped out a lot of those resources because they're 40 years. There's still oil down there, but much of the tremendous wealth is gone. And so those big oil companies, they sold those leases. They
mm-hmm.
sold their platforms. They sold their leases
mm-hmm.
to these small companies, like what you pointed out, Amplify, a company that just came out of bankruptcy. So now there's a company that has really no lease, no money, is now running this operation that was at one time was run by large oil companies. When it's time for them to decommission, they should all be bonded in the sense that there's got to be money put aside by these companies if we're going to allow them, which I think we shouldn't, but until we can figure out how to stop them, the first step that we have to do is make sure that we charge them a bonding fee. Right now, it's a minuscule amount of money. It hasn't been raised in years and years. So that you and I and the taxpayers, when they start this decommissioning process, and already of the platforms in California, there are 11 of them that are beginning the process of decommissioning. Not because somebody is telling me, because they're running out of oil.
Well, Congressman, we know that this pipeline, as you note, I think it used to be owned by Shell. This platform now it's owned by small company, and if they get dinged with fines for whatever happened here, they'll just declare bankruptcy. They'll be gone, The taxpayers will pick up the tab, whether it's federal taxpayers or state taxpayers. But Congressman, forgive me.
And we should charge them now before they go on taking another drop of oil out there, a tremendous amount of bonding money so that we can be assured a lot of them can, and let them go out.
I concur, but a lot of this, as you note, has to be done through statute, through federal statute. You've got a Congress that is, by and large, broken at this point, certainly when it comes to things like oil and gas. Good luck making changes there, but here in California, Congressman, Governor Newsom last week suggested it was easy to prevent new oil and gas leases. We haven't approved any for decades, but it should be noted that Frack Tracker Alliance and Consumer Watchdog, note that California oil and gas regulators have actually approved thousands of oil drilling permits since Governor Newsom assumed office.
That's right.
In January 2019. I guess those are on the old leases, but they are new drilling permits. Some of them, I think, are to abandoned wells.
That's right.
How do we stop that? That, at least, it seems like we have some control of here in California.
Right. Well, that's the issuance of permits is an agency or an executive thing based upon what is allowed by law. But that can all be quickly modified in California. That's not based upon federal.
Do you? I understand. Do you get any sense from the state officials? You were, as I said, speaking with Newsom last week, and I know you spent years in the Assembly and the state Senate here. Do you get any sense that the Democrats here in California are at least going to take action to shut it down where we can here in California?
You're now just talking about the development, because there are two things that California could do. One was to stop the pipelines that come from the federal elements.
Right.
And the second one is the issue you're raising is the not to provide permitting. It's one thing when you say no new leases, but once you already have an existing lease that's developing, there are permits to change the flow, to change the direction, to change the technology.
Mm-hmm.
And California doesn't have to issue those permits. They can stop it. And the question is, do I have a sense that the California legislature is going to stand up and say no more permitting of it?
Yeah.
And that's the issue around fracking, because fracking occurs when they give permits to existing leasing.
Yeah.
And so California, I think the first step has to say no more fracking, and because fracking needs a permit to do that. It doesn't need a new lease, but it needs a permit
right.
on existing existing
land. And we can stop.
California's going to do that.
Yeah, I mean, we can stop these, oil drilling, fracking permits, whatever they are, if, we want to lecture. And by the way, they deserve a lecture. But, if we want to lecture federal officials about how we need to shut this down amid our climate crisis, it would be nice if we started here in California to set the example for that. Congressman, I want to get in one more question here before I let you go. I know that as a member of the Progressive House Caucus, you're smack dab in the middle of the fight right now in D.C. for passage of the president's proposed $3.5 trillion Build Back Better Act to expand child care, health care, education, and take on our climate crisis in earnest for the first time. How does that bill, as it's currently written, does that take on offshore drilling interests in any way? And if so, will that part of the bill remain as this ongoing internecine fight between pretty much the entire Democratic caucus and Lord Manchin and Lady Sinema continues?
Well, that's a great question. I think that let me answer the second part of that question.
Okay.
In terms of what will remain and what will not remain as they cut the number, the types of programs or the number of programs that, and as you pointed out, the package at $3.5 trillion we felt was a compromise to begin with.
Right.
Originally, we wanted more than that. And we really want universal pre-K. We don't want that to be. We want community college. We want seniors to have increased Medicare coverage that they don't have today. We want to cut prescription drugs. We want to make sure that, you know, that we expand the tax credits. We want to make sure that corporations pay their fair share,
mm-hmm.
and those that are making. And so I think what we want as the progressives is to say, well, if you're going to cut these, don't cut the programs. By that, this is a 10-year program right now, the Build Back Better. Let's cut that back to the number of years.
Mm-hmm.
So we can deal, you know, instead of all the programs being 10 years and then just eliminating half these programs or,
mm-hmm.
as we go from 3.5 down to whatever we can get, as you point out, Sinema and Manchin to support. Let's cut on the number of years that that we're going to fund right away. And once those programs run out, we'll deal with that in the future. But at least we start this process and we put into law that the federal government wants to support. Now, that's what the Progressive Caucus wants.
I don't know
if it's going to happen.
Yeah, and that's what I'm worried about. And I know that there's, there's sort of the media are sort of painting this as, you know, the progressives versus the moderates. It's not really. It's, you know, the entirety of the Democratic caucus plus the president plus the Democratic Party leadership being held up by really, Manchin and Sinema in the Senate and a small handful in the House. But
because the Senate, you're right, had already agreed,
yep.
when they sent over the resolution, the $3.5 trillion. So we all understand the concepts that we want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not and moderates supported it also. So it's not, you're right, progressives versus moderates. It's the entire Democratic caucus being held hostage.
But here's my question for you, Congressman. I see frustration growing very quickly with Democrats and the president, fairly or not, and I think it's unfairly, but for not getting both the Build Back Better bill and the smaller $1 trillion roads and bridges infrastructure bill passed into law. I think that's unfair, given we've got, you know, two obstructionist senators essentially holding everything up on their own. But is there an adequate sense of urgency to get this done as you see it in D.C.? And the big question, will it get done, and at, you know, what ultimate cost to this proposed originally $3.5 trillion
deal? Well, I'm hoping that we keep the tax, we keep the pay-fors, the corporate taxes, the wealthiest, 2% paying their fair share. We keep all the programs. We just look at the length of time that we're going to fund them off this program, because once we mm-hmm. do that, once we can keep the programs in place, once people can see what they're getting, it'll be much more likely as we go forward in the future. And these are all paid for.
Yep.
I think that we didn't get that message. These are
yep.
all paid for. It's not going to raise people's taxes. They're going to get benefits that they've been waiting for years. These are not radical ideas. These are ideas that Democrats have been talking about for a long, long time.
Yes, they are. But
so
do folks in
time we do it.
But do folks in D.C. understand the urgency?
I think we do. I think we understand that we are not going, I think as Democrats, that you know, we're by the end of October, the beginning of November, by the time, you know, if we come towards the holiday, if we don't have all this done, we're in serious trouble. We're not going to get it done. And I think we appreciate the urgency. Right away, we have to make sure we can keep the government open, and McConnell and the Republicans are causing havoc. We have to be able, we want to get rid of the debt the way we're one of the few countries in the world that has, you know, you have to vote on it, on whether you pay past bills or not. That's crazy. We have to, but we have to do that right away, because by the 18th of October, if we don't get that done, we're going to, you know, not be able to pay our bills. But by the end of October, this is all going to get done.
I hope your congressman...
They're not going to remember whether it was done the 1st of October or not. The point is, let's get this all done, in both the Build Back Better and with all the programs in it, and the infrastructure, the bipartisan infrastructure package.
All we ask is you do everything in the world all at once. Congressman Alan Lowenthal, greatly appreciate your time today. Hope you might join us again in the future as all of this moves forward. He is, of course, the California Democratic representative for the state's 47th congressional district. You can follow him on the Twitters at Rep Lowenthal. Congressman Alan Lowenthal, really appreciate your time today. Please keep up the good fight.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we'll take a quick break. I know we're running really late. We'll take a quick break, come back with more broadcast. And by the way, if you're affected in one of the communities from Orange County spill, and if you've been to the beaches over the past week or you smelled oil, I'd love to hear how things are going for you. 818-985-5735 is our number. I hope to talk about something else when we come back, about the media and how they are doing in reporting what is actually going on in our country. And I'd like to get your calls on that as well at 818-985-KPFK. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to the Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. And surprise, surprise, Desi Doyen and I went a little bit longer with the congressman than I had planned.
Well, I don't blame you. It's kind of important stuff, and it's a lot to have to cover. I mean, it really does give you a sense of the scale of the task that is ahead to, you know, decommission, stop the new leases, stop the existing leases, stop the permitting, all of that. It's going to take a really long time to wind down and also to make sure that we protect fossil fuel workers in that transition.
Yep. We're screwed.
It is doable. It's just not going to be easy. That's all.
We've been discussing over the past several days on the broadcast, and this is what I wanted to take your calls on. Whether I'll have time anymore, I don't know. 818-985-5735. We've been talking about this last few days, including with Friday's guest, media critic Eric Bollert, that the corporate mainstream media and even elected Democrats themselves do not seem to be taking as seriously as they should the dangers posed to our democracy by the ongoing right-wing lurch toward authoritarianism in this nation. And I've been harping, for example, on the fact that even with the damning release of the Senate Judiciary Committee's report last week on Trump's attempted coup at the Justice Department to decapitate its leadership and replace it with a low-level Justice Department political appointee who was willing to falsely declare that the DOJ was investigating serious incidents of fraud in the 2020 election, and to direct state legislatures to potentially, you know, select their own slate of Trump electors instead of the Biden electors that voters had actually chosen. That even as along with Trump's call to the Georgia Secretary of State to threaten him to find 11,000 more votes to flip the state. You know, they've been describing this as an attempt to subvert or overturn or question the results. This was a blatant attempt by a sitting president to steal a presidential election. We now have a mountain of independently verifiable hard evidence in support of that, yes, very serious charge that Trump tried to steal the 2020 election. And it should be reported as such, not by questioning, subverting, overturning. He tried to steal a presidential election. A sitting president did. And this is a signal to me and to Bullard that we in the media, we're dropping the ball here. We are not doing our jobs adequately to warn about what is happening and what is coming in our country. I had Eric on the show to talk about this because I'm really not sure how we can all, and all of us in the media, including myself and the broadcast, how we can do a better job of it, given that none of us, frankly, has ever had to report on something like this in the United States. And I'm not sure I got a direct answer from Eric on that, but I'm going to keep trying, and we're going to keep talking about this because the alarm needs to be raised. To that end, I do welcome your suggestions on how the media, yes, including me, can do a better job of sounding the alarm. I want to play you a clip here, and then we'll get to whatever calls we have time for here. I'm at 818-985-KPFK. If you'd like to ring in with some advice for me, I welcome it. But while you hopefully ring in, this might help. I don't agree with everything Bill Maher has to say, especially lately, and I don't know that he's got everything quite right in his new monologue segment, new rules monologue segment from Friday. But I think it's close enough that it bears sharing today on the show in my effort to try and help sound the necessary alarm bells before it's too late.
Don't make me be an I told you so again. You know, I was a young man of 59 when I started using the term slow-moving coup. And it pains me to have to report it's still moving. A document came to light a few weeks ago called the Eastman Memo, which was basically a blueprint prepared for Trump on how he could steal the election after he lost it in November 2020. It outlined a plan for overturning the election by claiming that seven states actually had competing state slates of electors, which, well, not even remotely true, would have given Mike Pence the excuse to throw out those states and thus hand the election to Trump. But of course, the plan required election officials in those states to go along. Trump thought the ones who were Republican would. Most did not. And that's what he's been working on fixing ever since. Some presidents spend their post-presidency building homes for the poor or raising money for charity or painting their toes. Trump has spent his figuring out how to pull off the coup he couldn't pull off last time. Here's the easiest three predictions in the world. Trump will run in 2024. He will get the Republican nomination. And whatever happens on election night, the next day he will announce that he won. I've been saying ever since he lost, he's like a shark that's not gone, just gone out to sea. But actually, he's been quietly eating people this whole time. And by eating people, I mean he's been methodically purging the Republican Party of anyone who voted for his impeachment or doesn't agree that he's the rightful leader of the Seven Kingdoms. Yes, we're going to need a bigger boat. There was a grand total of 10 Republican congressmen who voted to impeach Trump. And by 2024, even those will all be gone. One of them was Liz Cheney, arch conservative. Daughter of Darth Vader. And yet now politically dead in Wyoming. Another of the 10 was Anthony Gonzalez. He's already bowed out for running for re-election because he can see opposing Trump means you have no chance. The other 8 will either, like him, not run, or they'll get primaried by a Trumper, or they'll have a sudden epiphany about how, come to think of it, Trump did win that election. The purge is also at work in Republican legislatures, as several states are already in the process of changing election laws so that they, nonpartisan election officials, are in charge of certifying the results. 2 weeks after the 2020 election, Trump famously called the Republican in charge of elections in Georgia, Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, and told him he just needed to find an additional 11,000 Trump votes. Raffensperger refused. But he's not going to be there next time. Of the 15 Republicans running for Secretary of State in the key battleground states, only 2 concede that Biden won that election. These are the people Trump is going to call on in 2024 when he's a few votes short, and these people are going to give it to him. So here's what's going to happen. 2022, the midterms, Republicans win big. Why? Because the out-of-power party always does in a country where the electorate can't think past, throw the bums out. So the Republicans take back the House, where disputed elections are decided, and the Speaker is Kevin McCarthy, a man with all the backbone of one of those inflatable tube men outside a car dealership. Republicans will also have more key governors. Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan all had Democratic governors who protected the vote in 2020. But they're all up for re-election in 22. At least two will lose. 2023, Trump announces his candidacy and starts having large rallies across the country, which become increasingly angry and threatening as Trump indulges his love for inciting violence.
Knock the crap out of them.
They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks.
Throw them the hell out.
Like to punch him in the face.
You know, I know the Hitler analogy is over the top in many ways. It is. I don't think Trump hates Jews. There are too many rich ones. And I don't think committing genocide is in his future. But the mentality of how to take over a country is exactly the same. Play on this feeling of, we have been cheated, robbed, betrayed, and now we're going to take it back. Two-thirds of Republicans believe the election was stolen. 21 million believe force is justified to restore Trump to office. A majority want to secede, whatever the hell that would entail. And yet, 2024 comes, and Democrats treat it as a normal election year. They are living in a dream world where their choice of candidate matters, their policies matter, the number of votes they get matters. None of it does. I won't even predict who the Democratic nominee will be, because it doesn't matter. It could be Biden. It could be Harris. It could be Amy Klobuchar. It could be Timothy Chalamet. As long as they have a D by their name, they will be portrayed as the leader of the army of Satan. But even if they win, Trump won't accept it. But this time, his claims of illegal voting by immigrants or mail-in ballots coming in after the deadline or the system was hacked by Venezuela or whatever Giuliani comes up with on the fly, they will be fully embraced by the stooges he's installing right now. December 16th, 2024. This is the day electors gather to vote for president. Arizona and Wisconsin both send a slate of bogus Trump electors, setting up a showdown on January 6th and daring Kamala Harris to do what Trumpers wanted Mike Pence to do, throw out election results. The difference being, this time, those results really are phony. And this time, it's not just 600 diabetic Fox News junkies and a nut in a Viking helmet. 10 million Trump voters have signed a pledge to come to Washington. Of course, 9.5 million flake. But 500,000 still show up, and they're heavily armed and incensed when Harris does what Mike Pence wouldn't. Demonstrations grow in the streets, the kind of Antifa versus Proud Boy violence we've seen in Portland erupts across the country. People are afraid to go out anywhere where their political tribe isn't in the majority, which hurts commerce. The stock market is spooked by the unrest and tumbles as Inauguration Day approaches. President Biden is under extraordinary pressure to do something to stop the coup before his authority over the military and the Justice Department evaporates at noon on January 20th. What happens when two presidential candidates show up on Inauguration Day, both expecting to be sworn in like a bad sitcom pilot? The ding-dongs who sacked the Capitol last year? That was like when Al-Qaeda tried to take down the World Trade Center the first time with a van. It was a joke. But the next time they came back with planes. I hope I scared the shit out of you. Thank you very much. That's our show. We're off.
Well, he certainly scared the bleep out of me. I can tell you that. And I already know all that stuff.
Yeah, but it's quite dramatic. And he lays it out, I think, in a very succinct and disturbing way.
You know, we haven't reported a whole lot on this program on the January 6th investigation or the Eastman memo that he referenced there for Mike Pence to toss out the Electoral College results on January 6th because, frankly, we had reported on all of that in advance of January 6th. We warned about that date pretty much every single day on this show between November 3rd and January 6th, while the rest of the media, you know, had moved on to other things. Oh, we got a new president, Joe Biden. So I don't know if Marr is right about the number of Democratic governors or secretaries of state or members of Congress who are going to be replaced by Republicans in 2022. But the odds and the history and the gerrymandering are certainly with him in his predictions. And I don't know if Trump will run in 2024, but he's certainly acting like it. And if he does run, he absolutely will try to steal the election again. His party is already paving the way for him to do that. They're passing laws to make it much easier for state legislatures to do exactly that. For any reason they conjure up to just change the results. The Constitution, after all, they claim, says elections are ultimately up to state legislatures, not to the voters, not to the secretaries of state, not to the governors, not even to the state courts. At least according to the constitutional argument that many on the right are now making and had already made before January 6th, as we tried to tell you at the time. Many more are now making that argument. Republican House Whip, I think, second in command for the Republicans in the House, Steve Scalise, he made that exact argument on Fox News Sunday this weekend as he refused to say whether or not the election was stolen from Donald Trump. So that's why it's so important that Trump's candidacy, frankly, be cut off at the knees with the indictments that are long overdue for many of the crimes that he clearly committed. Democratic law enforcement, whether it's the district attorney in Fulton County, Georgia, supposedly investigating Trump and his cronies for trying to steal the election in the Peach State, or, you know, whatever, if anything, that the DOJ might be looking at regarding any of the numerous crimes the former president clearly committed. Well, they better get with it and they better do it now. And the media must report all of these things as the crimes that they are. He did not challenge the results. He did not try to overturn the election. He did not attempt a self-coup. He tried to steal the election. And it needs to be reported as such over and over again because, yes, he is going to try to do it again. And Democratic elected officials need to start saying that out loud, no matter how polite they want to try and be. That luxury is gone. And all of us in the media need to do a much better job of explaining these threats to the American people. And I don't know how, but I will keep trying. If you have advice for me in the few minutes I now have left, 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. I would welcome your advice as to how we in the media can do better, how I can do better. Do you share these same concerns, or am I and Bill Maher and others overblowing the threat? If we have time, we'll get to your calls right after this. I know. Sorry, Des, I'm running late. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is the Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is supporting you and the things that you care about. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. Right now, as much as ever. If you choose to support us, you can do it really easily, safely, and quickly via bradblog.com/donate. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Bradcast, Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Kind of amusing. As I was playing Bill Maher, there in the previous break. CNN came out with an alert on the iPhone, I guess. What, read that. You got it there, Des?
Yes, it popped up on my phone. It said, CNN alert, Bill Maher says Donald Trump and the GOP might push America further towards autocracy in 2024. Here are six reasons to take that claim seriously.
Yes, good.
It's like right at the same thing.
Good.
You were saying, at the same time.
I think CNN is listening to the broadcast. Good. I'm glad that they are doing that. I'm glad that they are explaining to the public why this needs to be taken seriously. I hope they are explaining to themselves and to their own reporters why this needs to be taken seriously. I know we're up against the wall here. Do we have time for a quick call here? Let me go to Matt in Santa Maria, just coming in, because I've been promising calls all day, and as usual, got pushed off or took too much time with the congressman. And Matt, welcome to the broadcast, sir. What's on your mind, brother? Oh, Matt.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, great. Yes. You do a wonderful job, but one thing people need to realize, this is a pants on fire situation. People only need to study history to see how quickly things can change. And this country isn't guaranteed a happy ending.
No, it is not, which is exactly what we talked about with Eric Bollert. Did we lose Matt? Okay. I don't know how we lost Matt there, but that's what we talked about with Bollert. I think that there is this idea that, it's America. You know, the United States, everything's going to work out fine. It must be, you know, these crazy lunatics like Brad Friedman on the radio. They're just overblowing. They're over-concerned about this. Everything's going to work out just fine. It worked out fine last time. Well, you know what? If you read that Senate report, which should have had in its title the fact that Donald Trump tried to use the Department of Justice to steal the presidential election. But if you read that report, we came really, really close. We came really close to a full-on coup at the DOJ, which would have plunged this country into a place that we have not been since the Civil War. And I don't know that Americans understand that. Let me get one more, if I can. Harold in Santa Barbara. Hey, Harold, welcome to the broadcast.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to mention, don't forget, like Tom Hartman said, that almost every municipality within California and all Democratic states are controlled by Trumpets. Oh, I'm sorry, by the GOP.
Well, very good. Thank you, Harold. I don't know if they're all absolutely controlled in California by the GOP, but yeah, there's a lot of them out there here in California and everywhere in the country. And we need a plan, not for Democrats, but for democracy itself. I got to get out. We will continue this conversation in the days ahead. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my board operator, Federico Garcia, and of course, my guest today, Congressman Alan Lowenthal, Democratic Congressman from California's 47th, the Fighting 47th. We will be with you again tomorrow. Until then, you can drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am The Brad Blog. I will see you there. Until we see you here, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.